I'm Phil DeLuca.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And we are Commanderin.
Commanderin.
Yeah, and then there's music there. I always forget that cue. Thanks for listening, everybody. We're going to put a spotlight on community issues, but never, ever talk about four banned topics. We've had a few changes since our guest was on last. Religion, politics, Hearthstone, and hip-hop. No hip-hop discussions whatsoever. If you like what you hear and want to support the show, go to patreon.com/commanderinmtg and donate to us. Patreon allows you to give back to the creators you appreciate. Hopefully, that includes us. If you donate $1 a show, it helps immensely. And if you donate $10 per show, you get access to all of the hosts in our exclusive Facebook chat group. Patroni there also get to contribute to show plans, and they get sneak peeks and exclusive content, usually from Nate. Ah, Nate. You can also check us out on YouTube. We have lots of wonderful shows up there, including some of that exclusive content from Nate. So, this week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. We're going to talk about Aether Revolt and development. To do that, we brought an expert, none other than the lead developer for Aether Revolt and the Franken designer of Leovold, Ben Hayes.
Hey.
Okay, I can't be the only extrovert on the show this week.
I'll try to open up.
How you doing, Ben?
Hey, I'm good.
Welcome back. I know it was just like yesterday.
Yeah, it feels like yesterday, but I'm glad to be back. The last show was really fun.
Yeah. That was our Commander 2016 show, where, again, we focused on the development aspects of Commander 2016 and kind of tease you a little bit about a couple of the cards we'll be talking about later in this show. So welcome back. We're really glad to have you.
Yeah, glad to be back.
So how did you were the lead developer on Aether Revolt. How did you become the lead developer for Aether Revolt?
Being on the development team, there are a lot of projects that lead up to main booster sets that are sort of like stepping stones on the way to leading a product like Aether Revolt or like Kaladesh or you know, whatever booster set you can think of. So my progression was sort of working on stuff like intro packs and event decks, working in the FFL a lot, working on the modern event deck, working on Duels of the Planeswalkers, then going and working on Commander, Conspiracy, Commander again, and during that time also being on a lot of development teams. So I was on the development team as a member for Fate Reforged, Battle for Zendikar, and Kaladesh, and then also being on design teams. So really it's just being on a lot of teams, leading teams for ancillary products to get some of that leadership experience and to go through some of the steps in a little bit of a lower stress environment. Those products tend to have like less everyone watching them and scrutinizing everything all the time.
Sure.
So it's kind of a good learning experience. But going through things like telling the art directors which one of my cards need to have art commissioned for them this month and stuff like that. Things you would never really think of, just going through the process of like leading a commander set, you get to do all that stuff, but you get to do it for 50 cards instead of 200 cards.
Hmm.
And just building up all that experience, and then, you know, if the people, right, if my bosses are happy with the job I did on those products, then they'll give me, that's how I sort of ended up leading Aether Revolt, is people were happy with the other stuff I led.
Yeah, so you kind of prove yourself on smaller projects, and as you demonstrate more capability, you get larger and larger projects until finally a full set.
Yep. That's basically it. I mean, on Kaladesh, I was kind of in... We have some informal roles that we have for team members. Like, on Kaladesh, I was, for most of the team's duration, what we call, like, the strong second. So the person who the lead bounces a lot of ideas off of and relies on a lot and, you know, confides in, and that person's sort of always available to them to work through design challenges and things like that. Mm-hmm. And doing a lot of that on Kaladesh also prepared me well for Aether Revolt.
Oh, sure. Because you're immersed in the entire design ethos of Kaladesh and this, and presumably the story by the time that rolls around. So you were the strong design second on Kaladesh?
Development, yeah.
Oh, yep. For development, okay.
So that was with Ian. Ian Duke and Eric Lauer led that team together, and then at a certain point, Eric handed it off to Ian, and Ian became more of the lead, and Eric moved on to, you know, focusing on other products, and then I was sort of there as the strong second to Ian.
Oh, that's cool. I don't think we realize that development has a strong second concept as well. Mark Rosewater talks about it a lot on his podcast, where he has a strong second for design. And I've often wondered how that changed now that he is only half, or he's co-leading the big sets. So how did the strong second evolve in development, and how has it been affected by the two-set block?
I wouldn't say it's been affected too much by the two-set block, just because you still have the same kind of team structures. And one thing, right, we did intentionally sort of have me in both that role on Kaladesh and leading Aether Revolt so that I could be really involved in Kaladesh. As you said, like the story in the world and the how second sets definitely build off of what the first set establishes. So it was really important for me to be very familiar with everything mechanically too.
Right. That makes sense. Because you're going to have to develop the mechanics for the second set, and those are often based heavily on or related to the first set's mechanics.
Yeah. Even just talking about like what types of energy cards we made, for example, you know, it really helps me. So, let's imagine that I'm not so involved with Kaladesh, and the way that I would go about making new energy cards in Aether Revolt, looking at Kaladesh, I would say, okay, what's in the Kaladesh set file? And, okay, well, now I understand what's not in the file, and I'll just put those cards in Aether Revolt. Well, Kaladesh, in order to arrive at the cards that it ended up with in the file, probably tried 10 times as many cards as ended up, right? And if I'm there on the Kaladesh team, then instead of looking at just the final product and then working my way through the same discoveries and challenges, I can just jump straight to, oh, not only do I know what's in the file, I also know all the things we tried, so I'm going to get to the solution for Aether Revolt much faster.
Is that a standard process going forward? It produces a tremendously higher level of quality if you do it that way.
It's typically done that way, that the small set lead has a lot of involvement with the large set or the first set.
Neat. Yeah, we're going to dive into Aether Revolt a lot more. Before we even get to our news, did you manage to get to any pre-releases this weekend? Because... for our listeners, we are recording this on Wednesday, right after pre-release weekend. So we're only a couple of days out from the set formally being released.
Yeah, so I went to a pre-release at Mox Boarding House, which is a local game store, and went there for a couple hours. And, you know, when I go, I tend to just kind of stay around the edges and observe, kind of see what people seem to be liking and what people seem to be talking about. But I don't like to, unless I'm there in an official capacity, like spell slinging, which I do often, I like to kind of let people have their own space and their own experience. But so, I mean, a couple people, you know, open, or at least one person opened a masterpiece. I don't actually remember which one it was, but that's always like a really exciting moment for the whole pre-release. You know, everyone kind of like crowding around to see it and that sort of thing. Honestly, for me, like the going to the pre-release is sort of about like listening to what sort of things people are saying that I can then take as a learning for myself. So one thing that people were talking about that I wouldn't have really realized is, you know, I heard some people asking the question, you know, what's a permanent with all these cards that have Revolt on them? And just sort of the word permanent isn't a word we use a ton, especially at lower rarities. And so that was a moment for me of realizing something sort of about our player base and what they know and what they don't know and what's easy for them to pick up and what's obvious and what may not be as obvious as I thought.
Right.
You know, that's not an exciting story, but it's sort of like, that's the kind of thing that I go there to hear so that when I'm working on my next set, I can remember, oh, I actually had this experience of seeing someone try to work with this kind of rules text. Then we also have an internal pre-release that I went to and went 3-0. I had a really crazy green-black deck with Winding Constrictor and Rishkar, and like it was almost like some of the constructed decks I built for Aether Revolt, except it was a sealed deck.
So you got a good pull then.
Yeah, I had Rishkar, the green legend, and Yeheni, the black legend, and Winding Constrictor, as I mentioned, was a big MVP with a bunch of like just creatures from both sets that put +1/+1 counters on themselves, and then Armorcraft Judge, and just basically like my ideal black-green +1/+1 counters deck. And black-green's also probably my favorite color combination to play. Just really like grinding stuff out and reusing my resources and all kinds of Golgari stuff.
Mm-hmm. Nate and I have been known to play a black or green deck, sometimes both. So before we go too deep into Aether Revolt, we have some news in the league that I'm playing at Geeky Tees in Burbank. The drink, not any other way to reference tees. We're playing a Commander 2016 league, myself and four other people. I and one other player had to miss it this week, but Mario, the winner, says, yeah, the win was a little bit anticlimactic with three players. I was able to get a big swing into Jocelyn and kill Renee with Saskia's trigger, and next turn Jocelyn couldn't recover. So Saskia won the league on our third game. I'll say that's because Brea wasn't there, but, you know, Arthopter Queen.
Yeah.
Has a special place in our heart.
Brea is definitely one of the decks I would expect to do pretty well in a league. I think Brea and Atraxa were probably overall, like, if you play in the Biodome playing the decks against each other, I feel like those two have a bit of an edge. Although definitely every deck won, you know, at least a few times.
Yeah, once basically, once Yidris takes a offensive step, either that's being equipped with something that gives him hexproof or shroud, or attacks when unprotected, Brea manages to eliminate this threat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Has to happen. Brea very often, and if any of the people in the league are listening to this episode, you know, I am always willing to sacrifice for the greater good of the table. all right.
Who are you sacrificing?
A couple of nameless thopters. Well, maybe a couple of nameless servos.
Why don't you give them names?
You know, maybe I will. Maybe I'll have some custom tokens that just have names all over them. What would you name a thopter, Nate?
T1D2. T1D3.
Okay. Sorry.
You know, like Star Wars robots.
Yeah, like Star Wars robots, sure.
But it can't have a K in its name unless it's designed to kill people.
Oh, is that what the K is designates?
Yeah, there's K2SO from Rogue One, and in the Knights of the Old Republic, there's the HK-47 and HK-52 series.
HK, Hunter Killer.
Mm-hmm.
Is that part of K2SO's backstory, that K2 is a killer?
Well, he's a reprogrammed Imperial ass-kicking droid.
Yeah. We only saw the other one, and he was sort of, you know, stabbing it in the eye. So they're not like some kind of weird gorilla-armed maintenance droid?
No, you can make maintenance droids without gorilla arms, and they'll do maintenance just fine. But
yeah,
if you need to maintain the back of somebody's skull, then you need gorilla arms.
That's true. Yeah, if you need to clothesline somebody while they're running out of a transport, for example.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just grab them by the sternum and set them back down. Congratulations.
In other news, Ben, do you go to the website edhrec.com? Because Nate's writing there now. He's got articles up there.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I go to it sort of right when something EDH relevant is going on for me, whether I'm working on a set or a product and thinking about something for EDH and looking for references, or yeah, I'd say I go to it probably, you know, once every other week or so.
That's cool. Hey, when after you were lead developer on Commander 2016, did you take a little break from EDH? Were you kind of toasty, or were you like, no, I love it now more than ever? Not that you don't ever not love it. You know what I'm saying?
I mean, I spend a lot of time sort of immersing myself in whatever the thing that's relevant to the product I'm working on is.
Yeah.
So while I still like playing Commander and do occasionally, like when I'm focusing on main booster release, I'll do more of a mix of things. Like sometimes I'll play Commander, I'll, you know, draft a lot more. I'll go play in standard tournaments. So, you know, I like playing all different kinds of Magic, and just the type that I play the most kind of depends on what I'm working on.
Do you ever spell sling at a pre-release for a product you've worked on?
It's funny. Worked on, definitely. I did go and spell sling actually at most pre-releases that have happened since I've been working at Wizards. The first of those being Dragon's Maze, I think. That was the first set that came out after I started working there. And I think I've only missed spellslinging two or three pre-releases. And it's sort of, I guess it's ironic that I missed spellslinging at Aether Revolt when I do it so often, but I just had, life stuff happens and just didn't get around to scheduling it and didn't have free time last weekend.
Right. All you could do is get a couple of hours in, right?
Yeah, and if I'm going to be spell slinging, I like to be there for long enough that I can hang out, talk to people, entertain them, play with them, make sure I'm there for enough rounds that everyone who wants to play gets to play.
Yeah.
And this was more of like, I'm going to go to these pre-releases for as many hours as I can make myself free for. Like I could really dedicate a ton of time to it.
No, I've never seen a wizard spell sling before, but after you beat somebody, do you just kind of say, you should never have built that deck, and then knock the deck off the table?
No, we have training before we go out and spell. No, we do have a little bit of training, but in all seriousness, we bring packs to give away. Everyone kind of does things differently, but the baseline is you get a booster pack just for playing. One of my coworkers, Ryan Spain, has a system that I really like where he has a bunch of different booster packs, like a grab bag almost. And if you beat him, you get to pick a pack of your choice. And if you lose, you get to pick a random pack.
That's cool.
So you always get a pack, but there is some incentive to win. So you can pick the pack that, you know, has cards you want.
Yeah, does he throw some, like, Invasion and Onslaught in there?
Yeah, usually it's a mixed bag with some pretty good finds in there.
That's cool.
And then we just bring, you know, sealed decks of the format that we've built so that people can just go straight from playing in the pre-release round to between rounds playing playing with or against us. And sometimes I'll bring a commander deck. Sometimes I'll bring a standard deck just to play other stuff against people. Standard tends to be a little tricky because I'll bring a standard deck and the next set will be released, but not released to the point where people have updated their standard decks.
Uh-huh.
So usually I just end up playing sealed against people, but sometimes people want to play other stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, though, if you sit down across from a wizard and they have the set that is just released, and you're playing standard now with the set.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty neat. So we have an update on Sean, the astute listener and guest. May have noticed that Sean Watson is not with us this episode. Nate, we do have an update, though, don't we? He's...
Oh, yeah. He hijacked one of the cardboard dirigibles from the Aether Revolt pre-release at his local game store, and he is flying up to the peat bogs of the Scottish Highlands to hunt gremlins.
Well, let's hope he manages to visit a single malt distillery while he's there.
Mm.
As we all know, peat bogs are essential to their business, their way of life. So maybe we'll be able to check in with Sean a little bit later. It's kind of early in the morning for Sean, but we know he likes to get an early start when hunting for gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We have a very special segment this show, and this is the one we promised we would get to with you, Mr. Hayes, back in the Commander 2016 show. And this is a segment that we like to call The Watch List.
I remember chickening out of this before.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't chickening out so much as running out of time because we had a marathon show. It was wonderful. And I still feel terrible for, you know, you had like dinner to go to or something. And we were just pushing up against that.
Yeah, it ended up being fine.
Oh, whew. Good. So we saved it up for this time around. We have a very special two-part watch list this episode. Nate, you want to tell our guests and our listeners about the watch list?
So from time to time, Wizards of the Coast puts out some kind of card that it's so powerful that everyone in your meta has to adjust their decks to it. Either they have to destroy the card or exile it or control it, or maybe they just put it in their own deck. To name a few we've had on the watch list: Doubling Season, Lay of Old, Emissary of Trest, Deep Glow Skate.
What?
Mm. And this week we have two parts to our watch list. The first, Paradox Engine. Legendary artifact for 5.
Huh.
Whenever you cast a spell, untap all non-land permanents you control.
Oh my. Oh my. This sounds awfully familiar. 5 converted mana cost, permanent that untaps all non-land permanents you control.
Mm.
Sounds so familiar.
Yeah, if you've been playing against some Simic mana elf dork combos, or maybe some Kaideli Chosen of Kruphix, there's a card called Intruder Alarm, which is 2 and a blue enchantment. And the meat of this card is whenever a creature comes into play, untap all creatures. So if you got creatures that tap for mana, then you tap them, save up your mana, and then cast an elf. And then you untap all your creatures. Then you tap them all again for mana.
Tap them all again.
Then you cast another elf or something. And hey, maybe if you're playing Kaideli, then you're getting 12 mana each time you tap her. And yeah, so this Paradox Engine, it's like Intruder Alarm, but it untaps your mana rocks, too. How about that?
How about that?
Get you even more ways to get mana to cast more things.
It's almost like somebody missed Prophet of Kruphix.
Hmm. So, Ben, did you have anything to do with this card here?
I signed off on it. So, clearly, this card is powerful in Commander. No, I'm not going to argue that. from time to time, people in R&D look through card set files that they're not working on, just so everyone kind of has exposure to everything. And I definitely got some people sending me some internal flaming and yelling and screaming about this card.
Doom! Doom is here!
Yeah.
What was its playtest name?
Can you guess?
Doom Engine.
No. So you can see the art, right?
Yeah.
Let me see if the flavor text helps you at all.
Well, on the masterpiece, it's this device was submitted to the fair anonymously. It is imperative that its maker be found. We must understand it. Confiscation directive. And on the pack card, the pack version, Tezzeret says, one look at this glorious item convinced me that Kaladesh deserved my full attention. Sure enough, my time here has yielded exquisite fruit. Was it exquisite fruit?
No.
Let's see. The wheel with the marbles kind of looks like some old, you know, turn of the century, well, previous century artwork for perpetual motion machines.
You got it.
All right.
Yeah. The playtest name for this card was Perpetual Motion Machine.
All right.
And that didn't set off any alarm bells?
Nah, it's old school stuff. I totally won't argue. This is really powerful in Commander. I do think that while this, in a lot of decks, has the ability to generate a lot of value in Commander, in order to actually go infinite with it, you do have to build... You need to make deck building concessions, and this goes in a lot of decks, but I really don't think it goes in all decks. So it's a card I definitely thought a lot about, talked to a lot of Commander players in the building about, you know, looked at example decks trying to figure out if how good I thought the card would be in that deck. And you know, so when you're thinking about what I could do to change about this card, there's a lot of knobs that we can use as developers, right? Like I can change the mana cost.
Right.
Clearly you see it's legendary, which is a knob that's not as relevant in Commander, but very relevant in sets, formats with the 4-of rule. And then there's other stuff, like I could say, whenever you cast the first spell of your turn, or whenever you cast a spell, you can pay some amount of mana, untap all your non-land permanents. Or there's all these restrictions I could put on it. And one thing that I kind of tried to embrace while working on Aether Revolt was the idea that as Kaladesh is supposed to be this place of invention and anything's possible and... all of the things we're going for players wanting to feel when they play block, I really, as much as I could, tried to stay away from stuff like that and tried to say, okay, I'm going to write the clean text and figure out how much mana do I need to charge for this, instead of saying, okay, well, I'll charge you less mana, but I'll restrict this card in some way. I really tried to avoid those restrictions because I feel like they went against the spirit of the block.
That's reasonable.
Go big or go home.
I could be wrong. But, you know, you one thing we talk about in R&D and in development is if we went for the next 100 years making Magic sets and we never printed a card we regretted... And one thing you could know for sure is that we were probably being too conservative, and we probably weren't doing things that were as exciting as they could be and as interesting as they could be for our players. Which is not to say we try to do things we regret, but it's to say, yeah, there's some room to push the envelope and try things, and we try to be as good as our jobs as we can be, but also... we're not always going to be 100% sure, and we're going to be willing to go with stuff sometimes, even if we're not 100% sure.
Right. And you can always, it's always unpleasant, but you can correct it after it's released. So,
yeah.
Hey, Nate, Andy Bentley has a question, doesn't he?
Yeah, speaking of how to correct these things, how many employees at Wizards are in the pool for Paradox Engine getting the ban hammer dropped on it in Commander?
I don't think it's going to be banned in Commander. I would probably have, if I was confident that, I think this is banned in Commander, right? Like, that's the kind of thing that I would be sensitive to and try to adjust so that I didn't feel that way. I mean, like I said earlier, I could be wrong, but I'm not in that pool. I don't know how many of my coworkers are in that pool or if that pool even exists, but, you know.
Deny everything.
I signed off on the card because I really do think it's splashy, it's exciting, but ultimately I think it'll end up being okay.
Okay.
What do you think, Nate? Is this an exciting and splashy card?
It's splashy. It's going to make a splash.
It's going to make a splash.
And hey, if you're not playing Mana Dorks, run Cryptolith right, and then you are.
Yep. Yep. This will only be a problem in decks with...
things that tap to make mana.
Yeah, things that tap to make mana with White Mane Lion in it. Or Animar with... with what's the 4-mana artifact creature?
Which one? The Ancestral Statue or the Cloudstorm Curio?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Cloudstorm Curio, sure. It's an exciting card. And listeners, start using it right now. Because we don't have high hopes for this thing making it a year. It might. After all, Prophet of Kruphix lasted a year and a half. That was another Ben Hayes card, wasn't it?
Nope. It's funny. We actually talked about this last time.
Yep.
Kruphix was partially a Ben Hayes card, and over the years that has telephoned into Prophet of Kruphix was a Ben Hayes card, which I take objection to.
Mm-hmm. Now, you signed off on it, but patron Andy Bentley asked directly, was the Paris engine made by Ben Hayes?
So one thing I didn't realize before I had led a main booster release with so many cards in it is there are so many cards, they change so much, they change for so many different reasons. Sometimes a card will get killed entirely and we'll need to make a new card. Sometimes when I need to make that new card, there'll be people around who can help me. Sometimes there won't be. Sometimes I'll have one day, sometimes I'll have 2 weeks. Sometimes I'll only need to change a part of a card for one reason or another. What I didn't realize was it would quickly become impossible for me to remember stuff like this. So, to the best of my memory, something like Paradox Engine came over from the design file. But I'm not sure. Like, it may have also come from what we call hole filling.
Yeah.
Where we say, okay, there's 10 or 15 spots in the set that aren't really accounted for, and we have a really wide swath of the company submit designs. I'm not sure which one it came from, and there's only a couple of... There's a handful of cards in Aether Revolt that I remember. Yes, I remember sitting down, typing in those words, and hitting enter. Paradox Engine, I remember very little about.
So it was submitted anonymously.
The flavor text might be accurate, actually. Those aren't submitted anonymously. We do vote on them as a design team and which ones we want to pursue and which ones we want to use. We do that anonymously. But I mean, somebody knows who submitted it. Because we do things like recognitions, like when we send out the email saying, oh, these 10 cards from hole filling got used. This card was designed by this person. This card was designed by this person. Just so those people can have a moment of being publicly appreciated for adding that card to the set.
Sure.
But when we're talking about the cards and voting on them and saying which ones we like, we don't see the names of who designed them.
In an effort to avoid favoritism or just because it's irrelevant?
Just because it's irrelevant. I mean, like, it would be hard if we saw the names to not have some amount of bias towards people who have more game design experience.
Yeah.
And that shouldn't matter. I mean, we should just be reading the card and deciding whether we like the card or not.
Right, because it's possible for anyone to design a good Magic card. It doesn't matter where they come from.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just easier that way, and it avoids, like, what if I know my boss submitted this card? Like, is there going to be some part of me that feels more compelled to say nice things about that card? Or who knows? It's just simpler to not put the names on.
That's a good practice. Well, that was sort of a lead into our second watch list of the episode. Nate, do you want to intro this one?
This idea came from Patron Jackie Miller. We are watching Ben Hayes.
Yes, the very first time we're watching a human, a live human designer on the watch list. Why are we doing that, Nate?
Are you outside or? I'm right by my window. Look like anyone's there.
We have very high powered telescopes. So this Deep Glow Skate card, bubbling season, you were responsible for that?
Yep. I think I looked into that. Yep. I think I looked into that one and I discovered that, yeah, I did just type that one in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was that one when no one else was around and you had like 2 hours?
I don't know how much time I had, but I know I like the word double a lot.
Yeah, you do.
I don't think I do. I will say I don't know that I originally put it at 5 mana. I might have originally put it at a different mana cost, maybe.
Like 4?
No. I think I would say originally it had more power and toughness and a higher mana cost. And in iterating the set and talking about how to make the cards the best version of that design that we can print. Like, and by best, I don't mean strongest. I mean the one that's the most satisfying.
Yeah.
You know, someone just brought up like, hey, the cool part of this card is the ability, not the power and toughness. Could you skim some power and toughness off and cut the mana cost down a little bit so that it was a little bit easier for people to access the ability, which is what people actually want. Like, right. They were like, what does it matter if it's a 3/3 or a 5/5? Like, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, I really appreciate stuff like that because, you know, we, especially with Commander sets, we only get a limited number of new cards. And I always feel a little bit of regret when I see a really cool design that I think, oh, that'd be really fun for people to play with or really interesting for them to think about how to build around it. And we put it at a mana cost and a rate where it's just not really viable. Or it's because you can just do more powerful or flashier things for more efficiently. You know, not to throw a card under the bus, and I actually need to look this card's name up. Yeah, so Dream Pillager, 5 red, 4/4 flying. When it deals combat damage to a player, exile that many cards from the top of your library until the end of your turn. You may cast non-land cards exiled this way.
Hmm.
That line of text, when it deals combat damage, you exile that many cards and you can cast all of them. I remember, in hindsight, looking at Kim 2015 and being like, yeah, I thought that was the right mana cost for that card. But would it really have caused any problems if it was 6 mana instead of 7 mana? And is that ability something people would have enjoyed? I think it probably is. So that's the kind of thing where, looking back at what I did with Commander 2015 and thinking, I don't want to make those same mistakes. I want to put the cards with the abilities that people like at costs that they want to play with.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think on something like Dream Pillager, you could probably have gone to a 6, maybe even a 5. That might be a little bit too much of a bargain.
Then you'd be making different mistakes.
Yeah, but even so, like, right, you're saying, like, I don't even know. 5 might have been fine.
Right.
Like, so it's just a process that I went through learning from going through it once and, you know, kind of feeling like it is, especially in the case of a commander set where, like I said, we have so few new cards that we're getting to print relative to a main booster set that I want to make each one of them count. And I want to make each one of them relevant for someone who loves the card.
Well, that's a good principle.
And that's me and Deep Low Skate. And that's what I have to say.
it's a love story of sorts.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. We love it too.
Mm.
Flicker, flicker, flicker. So the next card on this list that we want to talk about here is Leovold, Emissary of Tress. Now, you had a direct hand at this one as well.
Yeah, I can't. So my memory of it is that either most or pieces of this card were submitted in some forms from a mini team that was put together during Conspiracy 2, specifically with the purpose of making cards that would be relevant for things like Commander, Cube, just looking at these environments and saying, what is missing from these various play environments, and what could Conspiracy have that adds something that these environments want, right? Like, looking at, right, what Sultai commanders are there? What do the Sultai commanders that exist let you do as far as deck building? And then what room is there to print something new that might encourage you to build a different deck? And that's sort of where, so Leovold came from a combination of people telling me, well, these are the kind of things that seem like they would be relevant in these formats and powerful, and then me taking that and putting it into a package that accounts for all the goals we're trying to accomplish.
And so someone on the team was like, Commander really needs another back-breaking legendary creature that makes sure no one has fun at the table.
I would say that before Leovold, and even now a little bit, Commander is high on legendary creatures that are awesome for you to build your deck around and do something proactive, and a little bit light on options if you want to be reactive and attacking other people's strategies. And like, not that that's what it should all be about, but there's lots of different types of players, and I just kind of felt like if you want to be doing this kind of thing, we just don't really have a lot of great options for you, and I want those players to have options. And I think, you know, if you look at the second ability of Leovold, like, the first one's obviously very aggressive, where he's actively shutting down your opponents trying to draw more cards. The second one is just like, don't mess with my stuff. So the kind of deck Leovold inges of playing your own permanents and not wanting them to be messed with, and not wanting your opponents to just draw tons of cards, is, like, it's weird to say, but in a lot of ways, Leovold kind of encourages everyone to play fair. granted, like, it's not fair because the restrictions don't apply to you, but he makes your opponents play more fairly.
Yeah, like, everyone gets no cards.
Right, except me.
Yeah, yeah,
right,
except
that's
me.
That's the black part.
that's totally fair. It is.
It's like communism.
Yeah, like the flavor text. I'm sure we can come to an arrangement. An arrangement where I get all the cards.
It's in Tress's best interest, really.
I feel like I'm like role-playing Leovold as I'm explaining. Like, I have to be a diplomat explaining you know, why Leovold is here and how it's all going to be fine for all of you. And don't worry, this is really fair, except, you know, obviously not nothing's 100% fair.
I mean, Leovold would say, you know, I'm here to make sure you are on a level playing field.
Right. All of my opponents are on a level playing field.
That's right. All of you are on a level playing field.
And isn't that what you wanted? Right?
And if it's not what you wanted, we're going to try it for a little while. yeah. Nate, what does Shivam have to say? Friend of the show, Shivam Butt, who is at Electro Total.
Seriously, Leovold? Do you just not like us or something?
No, I like you. I like all of you. I just want you all to play fair.
I like you all equally.
Yeah, exactly equally. I like you all one card per turn and no more than that.
Sometimes less.
Yeah.
Was he good friends with Teferi?
Leovold? I don't think they've met, but maybe. I mean...
Well, he's got his puzzle box.
Maybe Teferi will go hang out with Leovold someday. Yeah. I don't know. They it's true. They do have some good synergy with...
And Leovold's an elf, so he's been around for a while. Could be.
Oh, yeah.
Nate, you have a question.
Yeah, so with these Aether Revolt cards, how much were you involved in creating the expertise cycle of cards?
So I was involved in the base abilities. So if you think of how they have a spell effect, and then they all have the unifying ability of letting you play a card that costs less than them for free. So the play a card that costs less than me as a pitch for a cycle came from the design team, and they all had upfront abilities. My biggest contribution to that cycle was determining what the upfront abilities would be. So like, you know, we went through a bunch of different abilities for the red expertise, and we changed the numbers a bunch on the black expertise of different mana costs, different amounts of minus some number, just shuffling them all around to get them to a point where they were each individually exciting, but also each doing something different from the others. So this is the thing where we have cycles. Something we really try to do is not overlap too much. You can see, like, only one of the cycle draws cards. Right? Like, the green one draws cards based off a creature's power.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say, like, okay, that effect, card drawing, we're not going to reuse that. Only one of them makes tokens. Right? Like, the green or the white one, or even potentially the red one, could make tokens in Color Pie, but like, okay, we're saying the white one is going to make tokens, so the other ones aren't going to make tokens. That was my contribution to the cycle, but the free spell cheaper than me was how they were handed off, and we fiddled with how much cheaper that would be. You know, we tried different numbers and ended up just feeling like one less than me was what we found to be most reasonable and fun and intuitive and the intersection of all the things we were looking for.
All right.
Did that take a couple of months to figure all that out?
They were definitely some of the cards we talked about and playtested and iterated on and discussed the most. You know, looking at the set, like cards that got a lot of attention, the Planeswalkers, the Revolt and Improvise cards got a lot of attention because they kind of ask you to make some deck building conceits and adjustments. So we really worked on, like, okay, what does a deck that plays Revolt cards look like? What does a deck that plays Improvise cards look like? The expertise cycle for sure, because we knew that that was sort of you know, potentially dangerous space to play in. We play tested those a ton and talked about them and made sure we were getting them to a spot we were all happy with.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say they're in the group of cards in the set that got the most attention.
Nate, you think they're Commander staples, right?
Yep. All those expertise.
Yeah, they're pretty good cards.
Yeah, one thing I was excited about with the expertise is being able to get some effects that you might not normally think of as very playable into more formats because of the utility of the second ability, the casting a spell for free part. Like, I think that it's really hard to make a fun, exciting, playable threaten effect. So I was really happy with Karizev's expertise, where sometimes this is a lot more than threaten. Like, if you have a 2-drop, it's great. If you have a 1-drop, it's pretty good. But sometimes it's just threaten. And I like those sort of high variance cards that, you know, can be in a wide range of how good they are. But then I liked being able to have these effects show up and be powerful because we had this extra text tacked on there.
Well, good work.
Thanks. I'm really looking forward to, you know, the upcoming, especially the upcoming standard tournaments, to see what people do with the set. But then also, you know, plenty of formats. Like, I'm going to be keeping an eye on Commander articles, threads, seeing what people are liking and how that's going.
Oh, that reminds me, Nate, we didn't ask, what's your next article?
Oh, on EDH Rec? I'm not sure of the publishing schedule. You might have seen Ishai Ojitrad Dragon Speaker by now. Or you might be looking at Tana the Bloodsower or Silas Wren.
Mm.
Seeker Adept. I want to stagger them so I'm not using the same color commander for two articles in a row.
Right. So Commander 2016 was the last set released before Aether Revolt. And counting it as a set, right? So with a separation of only 2 months, does that mean that you were working on Commander 2016 and Aether Revolt at the same time?
Nope. We have different timelines for different types of projects, and they bumped each other very closely. I had a very short break, but I don't think I was ever working on both at the same time. Even though, right, like, making Commander 2016 and making Aether Revolt each took longer than 2 months, one of them, you know, spent longer in different parts of the process, and so my time was just broken up.
That's, it's very intriguing to me as a project manager to figure out how all of that works. So you went back-to-back pretty much, but they were back-to-back, and I'm not asking what order it was, but Commander 2016 and Aether Revolt?
Yep, they were back-to-back.
So how does a standard set, developing for a standard set, differ from developing Commander products?
One of the biggest things is the set's going to impact Standard. So you've got the whole group of people who regularly play the FFL giving you constant feedback on what's working, what's not working, what's too powerful, what types of decks we want to enable, and what cards in the set aren't getting there to make that deck work. So whether we're moving cards up in power or down in power, what cards Standard needs at this moment from set that it hasn't gotten yet in the rotation of the blocks. Also, there's draft, right? Like, I'm playtesting draft if I'm developing something like Conspiracy, but if I'm developing Commander 2016, it's a lot more playtesting Biodome games, playtesting these Commander cards in other environments. But with Aether Revolt, right, I'm playing sealed deck and draft playtests. I'm having my team think about draft, sealed, standard, all the feedback we're getting. So I would say it's a lot more feedback from a lot more sources with a lot more goals and constraints and needing to balance more competing goals and interests and drivers of what a card wants to do. Whereas in Commander, it's just kind of like, question one, we played Commander with it, did we have fun? Question two, is it going to break Legacy or Vintage?
Standard is a much more fragile environment.
Yeah, Standard's got a ton of moving pieces and sets going in and sets coming out, and you know, the various effects that exist in the format at different rates, like what's the best red removal spell, what's the best white removal spell, what's the best wrath, and if you print a card above or below these thresholds, right, like you can change the whole environment with one card,
mm-hmm.
being, you know, one mana less or one mana more. So it's a much higher tension, higher attention from more people, more input, more iteration, and basically it boils down to more questions that we need to answer before we know exactly what a card needs to be.
Right.
So instead of that two-step process, it's more like a 10-step process.
Yeah, and even with that much attention, sometimes things slip through, as we've seen in recent weeks, right? Not addressing anything in particular, but, you know.
We're never going to see everything, and one thing we talk about is if we could solve the format and the environments of the sets we were releasing internally with the number of people we have,
right,
then, you know, we'd be kidding ourselves if we said that would be interesting when you take the number of people and multiply it by huge factors and the number of hours. And we kind of understand that we can't release a product we've solved, because that's not going to sustain our players, because there are so many more of our players than there are of us making it. It's a little bit of a tricky thing to settle into and embrace, like kind of knowing that we're making a lot of judgment calls and using our best instincts and experience and judgment in those areas, but ultimately saying like, yep, we didn't solve all of this, because if we could, we wouldn't want to print it.
Right, right. I mean, you've got something on the order of 15 million users who are going to play the game within 30 days of release. And they are going to spot things that, I mean, you could have the largest game test team in the world, and the players will spot it, will spot things that the playtest team cannot.
Yep, exactly.
So related to Commander, obviously this is a Commander-themed podcast, the professor has suggested, at least as early as our show number 14, and more recently on the Commander's Brew episode 78, and everybody should be listening to Commander's Brew and watching the professor, right? They are both great shows. But he suggested releasing Commander cards in Standard. And one of the things he suggested on the Brew was, like, how much fun would it have been to see Partner written on a card released through a Standard booster. So why aren't Commander cards released in a Standard set?
Maybe a better way to phrase that or think about it is, it's not that we don't release Commander cards in Standard releases. It's more that we don't reference formats on cards. So just like we don't release any cards that reference Modern or reference, right, any of our formats, we kind of like to keep the cards in the main booster releases as agnostic as they can be, so that you can take them and make whatever you want to make out of them. So this might be taking it a little far, but if you think about, like, Commander was made by players who took these building blocks and pieces and thought of different ways they could play with them and different things they could do with them. And I feel like it's a little bit sacred in those Standard releases to have them be agnostic in that way, format agnostic, and sort of open for whatever people want to do with them. And then take these formats and say, here are these meta constructs of ways you can play if you want to find other people who want to play the same way you want to play, but keeping the the card sets really clean and sort of with a, right, anything's possible because we're not being prescriptive and telling you what this card's used for or where it goes and what to do with it.
Well, how about cards that say draft on them, that have the word draft? Because that kind of is implying a kind of format.
Yeah, so Conspiracy and Commander were both released very much targeted at a specific audience. But then we always have this main booster release in the middle that can point anywhere you want it to point. And sort of keeping those separate so that the main booster release is always inviting to anyone who wants to come in and play with it in whatever way they want to play with it. But then if you already know what you like, if you already know that you like draft, you can pick up a product like Conspiracy, and the cards might reference drafting on them because we've released that product for a specific audience.
All right.
Hey, when Design handed over Aether Revolt to you and to the development team, obviously, and I know there's a transition phase called Devine, what was the biggest challenge you had making what they wanted to happen a reality? Because Design hands over mechanics and some broad concepts and says, we want this kind of experience. And then you as a developer and you, the development team, have to make that really work. So what was the biggest challenge?
I would say the biggest challenge was figuring out the best way to have the themes of artifacts and artifice and inventions, and then separately this revolution come through in the gameplay and in the mechanics and to the players. Like, it's pretty challenging to capture that, and so it's what we spent a lot of time working on and talking on and going back and forth on with the two teams of what does it mean to have these themes come through, what types of cards and gameplay patterns make you feel this way, what types of mechanics lend themselves to that. So, I mean, I guess the biggest challenge was just the core challenge, right, of taking what we all knew we were trying to accomplish, making a set on Kaladesh about artifacts with inventions, with this twist of instead of happy, fun inventors fair land, it's now a full-scale revolution, and what does that mean? So coming to mechanics like Revolt and figuring out that we wanted to have an artifact matters mechanic to pay off the block, and there was room to have an artifact matters mechanic that Kaladesh hadn't used. You know, if Kaladesh had had something like Improvise or something like Metalcraft, then that would not have been a new thing with Aether Revolt. But one thing we looked at is, oh, Kaladesh didn't really have an artifact matters mechanic that had a name. So that's a great space that Aether Revolt can pick up and round out the block with.
That's cool. Now, before we get to our lightning round of questions from our various contributors here, do you have five favorite Aether Revolt cards?
Yeah, I've got a few favorites.
All right.
Let me see how many favorites I have where I can actually remember the playtest name.
The playtest name is sort of like a bonus, because it's always fun when we hear the playtest names.
Okay, one of my favorite cards, and one of the cards I previewed, or mechanized production,
yeah,
the blue mythic aura with enchant an artifact you control. At the beginning of your upkeep, create a copy of the artifact, da-da-da-da-da. If you control eight or more artifacts with the same name, yeah, you win the game. So this card I really like, because I also like writing you win the game on cards. And the playtest name for this was Assembly Line.
Oh, cool.
Which fits pretty well. Like, same idea. I always, like, am interested when the playtest name is, you know, really close to kind of the where the concept ends up.
Yeah. Mechanized Production is a great card.
Yeah, that's one that I'm super excited to play with, and and see what people do with it. You know, it is a challenge, but I think it's a manageable challenge where a lot of these you win the game cards are like, oh, sure. Sure.
If you got away with that, sure. You deserve it. So what's your favorite artifact that has been mechanized, productioned?
I mean, there's the classic, which is just putting mechanized production on a prophetic prism. Right, you draw a card every turn, and then 7 turns later, you win the game. That's like the old standby. For something a little more spicy, I saw mechanized production on a consulate turret, the one that taps to give you an energy and tap pay 3 energy to deal 2 damage to target player. That was a really interesting one because it was all about figuring out if the turrets would kill the person first or if the mechanized production would kill the person first.
Have you seen it on a worm coil engine?
I have not seen it on a worm coil engine. I saw it on Universal Solvent, the 1 mana with 7 tap, sacrifice, destroy permanent. So that's pretty sweet. I saw it on Treasure Keeper. Whenever your Treasure Keepers die, you effectively cascade into a 3-drop or 3 or less. I think that mostly covers the things that I've mechanized productioned. Other favorite cards, I would say another blue card. So Whir of Invention is a card that's really close to my heart because I really love the card Court of Calling. And obviously this has a lot of similarities to Court of Calling. It's the X, triple blue, improvise, search your library for an artifact that costs X or less. So clearly a pretty strong callback. I sort of shepherded this card along through the process more than I would most cards and just asked like, hey, could it have a name, something of something to be even more of a callback? And then one thing I like is if you even look at the art of this and the art of Court of Calling from the original art with the big bird.
Yeah.
Like the ship, the airship and the bird are sort of similarly positioned in the frame. And even that, like, I nudged in that direction where typically will be really hands-off. So this is just a card that's kind of important to me because I wanted it to turn out a very specific way, and I ended up being super happy with how it turned out.
Cool.
The playtest name for this card was Cord of... Can you guess?
Cord of...
Probably rhymes with calling.
It doesn't rhyme with calling, but it does start with C. Oh, I guess it does rhyme with calling. Yeah, I don't know how rhymes work. It does rhyme with calling.
Okay.
We're not supposed to talk about hip-hop, but it was Cord of Crafting.
Oh.
But Cord of Crafting isn't actually a thing. Like, that sentence doesn't mean anything. What chord are they playing that crafts? It falls apart really quickly, so I was really happy with the name Whir of Invention.
Still sound-based.
Yeah, yeah. Let me see other cards.
Well, how does the Panharmonicon do its thing? It's just making music. Music can do anything. It's the power of life.
That should have been my argument. That would have done it. I like Pacification Array a lot. Icy Manipulator was a card that, I saw a lot growing up just with the sets I was playing with, and it was always a really iconic card. And it was interesting to think about, we took off tap target land because it's not really a thing we do much in Magic anymore. But it was interesting to think about, like, if we want the base mana cost to be really low so that it works with improvise as something you can play early and tap to reduce the cost of your spells, how much do we actually need to charge for the activated ability? And just learning that, like, oh, even increasing the cost of the activated ability, the cost you pay every time, by 1, lets you reduce the upfront mana cost by a lot. It was just kind of like an interesting thing for me to realize working on the card and working through the numbers.
That's cool.
I don't remember what the playtest name was for that one. Renegade map I was really proud of. The one mana enters the battlefield, tap, sack, search your library for a basic land. Just the variant on Traveler's Amulet, but a Traveler's Amulet that worked really well with Revolt, because you could Revolt on curve, whereas with Traveler's Amulet, whatever turn you sacrifice it, you're down a mana, so whatever Revolt creature you're playing has to be one mana less than however much mana you've developed up to that point. But obviously ETBing tapped is a downside. So Renegade Map was a card that just, really, like, as I started to think about, okay, if Revolt is in the set, what are the other cards we want to have around it? What kind of designs make sense? Renegade Map was one I was pretty proud of. Playtest name for that might have been Renegade Map, because just like the theme of Revolt being the Renegade mechanic was established early on, and typically these cards that find lands are related to navigation in some way, and I'm not sure, but it's definitely possible that that playtest name was just Renegade Map.
Yeah. Nate, that was the one that Sean Main said he saw become weaponized at the employee pre-release, right?
Yeah, they put the enchantment on it that makes it so you can tap it to do 2 damage.
Oh, yeah. What's that one? The Quicksmith Rebel? The one that gives the ability to the artifact?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's cool. It's good to hear your favorite cards from Aether Revolt. And are those all ones that, all cards that you designed or had a hand in?
Let's see. The map, yeah. The array, I think so. Mechanized Productions was assembly line. It was, I believe it was handed off from design, or possibly that was a hole filling one, but I think it was handed off from design. I added the you win the game thing to it. It was basically just the card, except a copy of Enchanted Artifact, period, no more text, and it was a rare. And we had room where we wanted to, you know, I wasn't super happy with whatever our blue mythic was. And I loved this card, and it got, you know, really high ratings every time someone talked about it or looked at it. And I was like, yeah, what if I add some extra text to this and bump it up to mythic? And I was really happy with the results. So definitely the design isn't mine, just I tweaked it a bit.
Yeah, very cool. And then, of course, Were of Invention, very close to your heart.
I know a group of us made a bunch of improvised cards. I want to say Were of Invention was either me or Ethan Fleischer, but I think it was me, but I'm not sure.
Very cool. Thanks. That's sort of behind-the-scenes stuff. We just eat it up. We have a few lightning round questions for you, if you don't mind sticking with us for a few more minutes.
Yeah, sure, no problem.
All right, lightning round. Question one from Bill Dracula. How do you work with the creative team to determine if a monkey's fangs are really representative of a 2-1 and not a 1-1? This is in reference to Ragavan,
yeah,
the legendary monkey.
Mostly, like, it is a handoff process, right? Like, I tell them, this token is a 2-1, and this creature is a 1-3, and all the details. And then they work out what the best creative fit for all of that is. So
yeah, but just like you nudged Court of Invention, wouldn't you nudge them into, no, make his fangs a little bit bigger? Those are like 1-1 fangs. Make them a 2-1 fang.
Usually it goes the other way. Usually it's like, usually it's creative saying, no, you really shouldn't make that. You shouldn't give that an extra power. Like, the art really doesn't support the extra power. So it's often a give and take and a negotiation of what works and what doesn't work. But I think Ragavan was probably always just a 2-1 and just a very aggressive monkey.
Henry Stukenborg asks many questions. Question 2. How does he know if a card meets the intended goal of the slot it is designed to fill?
A a lot of that stuff gets communicated in the handoff. So, you know, whoever the lead designer is and the lead developer will get together and talk about, okay, here's all the cards that are important to the identity of the set. Here's what their goals are. Here's what I had in mind. And then a lot of the set is there to support the play environment and is thematic, but isn't like a centerpiece or a supporting wall or things like that. And so really it's just communication between the two set leads of what's really integral and important and why is it important. So I guess the way I know is I ask the people who put the stuff there.
Question three, the Aether Revolt uncommons and even some commons appear more pushed than many previous sets. What is the goal with pushing power down the line?
Different sets have different amount of powerful cards at different rarities. Like, I think that some of the mechanics in Aether Revolt lend themselves well to making constructed cards, and we want mechanics to appear at a variety of rarities, so that might be one of the things at play, one of the reasons you might be feeling like Aether Revolt has more powerful commons and uncommons than some other sets. Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of wanting to vary things up and a little bit of just how the chips fall and a little bit of a lot of things that add up to that.
Question four. Does the change back to the previous block schedule make Standard more powerful than WotC originally intended?
So not rotating out Battle for Zendikar block will make the environment more powerful. More cards being in an environment basically just does that as long as there are powerful cards in all the sets that are in the environment. But given that a lot of decks are built on synergies and play and counterplay and things like that, all the synergies in the upcoming block are still intact and still functional and still, we would think competitive. And yeah, I mean, it makes everything a little bit more challenging to impact Constructed, right? Because if Constructed Standard is at a higher power level, naturally, if you introduce another set, it's just going to be harder for that set to have an impact, right? Like, you think of the number of cards in a set that see play in Standard versus the number of cards in a set that see play in Modern. The number in Modern is much lower because the format is much more powerful. So, sure, there's challenges, but I think a lot of the stuff we put in there to work a certain way will still largely work the same way.
Question five. What is the process when designing legendary creatures and their color identities?
Sometimes legendary creatures start from a color identity, and mechanics and certain goals for that combination of colors and mechanics. And other times they're more creative driven. With the case of the five legendary creatures in Aether Revolt, the five monocolor legends, those were five characters from the story that we wanted to highlight and we wanted to play up more on cards. And so while it may have made them more flexible for Commander, for example, that's not always the top priority, right? Like, the priority list shifts depending on what cards we're talking about. And with these cards, it was more important to just be very clean and say each color is getting one character that we're playing up and representing from the story. And so we didn't do things like add a colored mana symbol in the activation of Yeheni to give it an additional amount of color identity in Commander, because while Yeheni works as a commander, that wasn't necessarily the top priority for that card.
Question six. What lessons have you learned from the 2016 Commander product?
This might be a little bit of a cop-out, but I feel like for me, it's a little bit too early to say. Like, there's definitely some real takeaways for me personally. I was nervous and skeptical about the idea of four color. I thought it was going to be super challenging to design and super challenging to develop, and it was. And I was nervous and hesitant around that thing. And I guess the biggest lesson, the biggest sort of philosophical lesson for me from Commander 2016 was, just because something is going to be really hard isn't a good reason not to do it. On a more tactical individual card level, I would say I take more of a long view of things. And so I'm still absorbing what people are doing with Commander 2016 and not really willing to say, oh, I know what impact this has had yet. I'll probably be saying that kind of stuff 6 months from now when the cards have had more of a chance to breathe and go through iterations and go through what people explore and do with them, and then I'll say, okay, this stuff worked, this stuff didn't work.
Question 7 from Patron Jackie Miller. Why exactly is Hope of Ghirapur legendary?
Because it's from the story, and there's only one of it. It's the Thopter that gets launched out of the heart of Kirin to... I work on so many sets and so many blocks that I'm...
To destroy or shut down the Planar Bridge.
It's either to shut down the Planar Bridge or to shut down, like, the Consulate area of the Consulate Tower or the... Yeah, it's basically like an EMP kind of deal, I think.
Yeah, as of the current story, it's loaded with a disruptor, and then Dovin Bon takes it apart, ruins it, and then our hero, Chandra, gets into it, along with Gideon at some point.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's legendary because it is a... Thopter from the story. It is a specific thopter that has a specific purpose, and its mechanics, you know, largely reflect what it does in the story. So a lot of people thought, you know, internally, oh, it's weird to have a one mana, one, one flying thopter that's, why is this thing legendary? And it's like, well, it's legendary because it is part of the story. These mechanics match up with the story, and this is, you know, in a way, a character in our story.
They only had the one photon torpedo. And they gave it a name. See, you got to give your thopters names.
Yep, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So, question 8. What kind of pizza do you like the best? New York, Chicago, Milwaukee crackers, Sicilian? What other types are there, Phil?
Well, I added all those types. She just restricted it to the question. I was opening this up for a discussion because, you know, people who like New York pizza sometimes don't like Chicago, and then Milwaukee has this cracker-like thing that's pretty decent for what it is, but I wouldn't call it pizza. And Sicilian, of course, is mostly seen in New York and has a totally different texture from Chicago, but a lot of people think it's Chicago. They are so wrong.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I like New York pizza the most. That's where I'm from.
How do you feel about pasta on your pizza?
Pasta on my pizza?
Like macaroni pizza? You've never had this?
I don't think I've ever really had that, no.
First had it in New York. It's fantastic.
Okay. I'm pretty adventurous when it comes to food, so that sounds really good. That sounds like something I'll definitely try next time I'm there.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on pineapple?
I like pineapple sometimes. It's not an every time thing for me on pizza. Like, we order probably 15 different kinds of pizzas when we have our internal pre-releases. And, you know, I'll take like one small slice of the pineapple pizza and then, you know, a couple slices of other stuff.
It's pineapple and ham, right?
Yeah. If I'm ordering pizza for myself, I'll almost never order pineapple, but... I like it. I I'll have a little bit of it if it's there.
What's your preferred pizza, you know, in terms of toppings?
It depends on the place, but my two go-tos are either just kind of a straight-up pepperoni pizza or a margarita pizza.
Mm-hmm.
It depends a lot for me on, like, how they prepare the pepperoni, whether they're more, like, crispy and thick or just kind of floppy. Like, not a huge fan of just the more salami-like pepperoni. But if the pepperoni is a certain quality, then I like that a lot. Otherwise, just margarita pizza or even just a plain slice I like a lot.
Yeah, when I was in San Francisco this last weekend, my friend had a slice of pizza with pepperoni on it, and all of the pepperoni had curled up and was sort of toasted along the top, and that was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a couple places where, you know, I'll get just a straight pepperoni pizza every time. I'd say that's probably my favorite if I'm going to a place where I know they do it a way that I like it.
Yeah, my standby is just a plain cheese.
Oh, yeah.
Just a plain pizza. Just, I want to see what that is. If you do all right by that, then I'll try your other pizza. And if not, then to the bin.
Yeah, I get plain cheese plenty. Like, I have no problem with just trying a plain slice.
Where do you get good delivery up in Renton?
There's one place that does okay. There's a place called Jet City Pizza.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In Newcastle, I want to say, probably 5 or 10 minutes north of me. They do a pizza. They do like a specialty pie that I really like that has, what does it have? Jalapeno, sausage,
mm-hmm.
Onion, and then I think it has cashew or peanut on it.
So you're like, okay, you're not in New York, you're ordering pizza from this place anyway, you might as well just have something that tastes interesting and or probably good. It doesn't have to be actual pizza, though.
It's what it is. I don't have those expectations, and I just found a pie that they make that I like just because it has a combination of things on it that I like eating.
Yeah.
So that's my go-to here. But I eat a lot of pizza when I go back to New York.
Yeah. When I go to New York, I pretty much eat, and this is horrible, I pretty much only eat pizza, bagels, and hot dogs.
Yeah. I went to a place called Criff Dog when I was in New York this last time, which does a bunch of, like, interestingly toppinged hot dogs, and they do fried hot dogs. Like, they fry the hot dog a little bit, which was really interesting.
Do they butterfly it first? Or,
yeah, they do. Yeah, they do.
They split it down the middle?
Yep. So that was really great. And then, actually, every time I go to New York, I bring a couple dozen bagels back for various coworkers who love bagels and don't go back as often as I do.
Yeah, in fact, Nate just ended up with some New York bagels.
Yeah, I did.
Have you had them yet?
Yep. I had some smoked salmon in the fridge and cut up a tomato, cream cheesed it up.
Yeah, my first breakfast back here in California was toasted New York bagels with scrambled eggs and cheese and some actual lox that we bought in Santa Monica.
That sounds really good.
Mm. Yeah, it was really good. And I had my last half a bagel. It was a plain, unfortunately, but my daughter claimed the sesame and my son claimed the egg. So.
Yeah, I think we're out from what we brought back from this trip. But I think a couple of my coworkers still have some.
Well, they got, you know, they got to eat it fast.
Yeah.
Woo, we went pretty deep there. I didn't expect that. Nate, when you order pizza in San Francisco, where are you ordering the pizza from?
Usually, for good pizza, probably Patchy's. It's Chicago style, though.
Mm. That's okay.
So it's, you know, it's got a couple layers and stuffed with usually sausage for me.
Yeah.
Maybe bacon.
I had Tony M's Slice House. And there's one on Haight Street and there's one up on North Beach as well. You know, being completely ignorant of any other pizza joints, so I would want to try the one you were recommending. That's where I recommend people go for actual pizza.
Go to Tony's.
Yeah, right. That's Sicilian, where Sicilian, like, it's almost like crunchy, right? Almost. And I didn't try the Sicilian this time, but I'll try it next time.
Oh. All right, then.
L.A. pizza to look forward to. All right. Well, Ben, you've been a wonderful sport. You've stayed extra long. This is a super-duper long episode. How can people reach you?
People can find me on Twitter at Ben, like my first name, the letter B, and then Hayes, like my last name. Twitter's the best place to get in contact with me. You know, I answer questions when I can. You know, obviously there's a whole bunch of things that I'm not really going to talk about on social media. You know, the obvious ones being, you know, what's in the next set.
We have it on very good authority that Islands are in the
next set.
All
right, I did tell you guys that last time. but yeah, if you ask me a question that is in bounds of what I can answer, then I'm usually happy to have chats on Twitter about that kind of stuff, or, you know, through direct message over Twitter if that's that's a good place to reach me.
Cool. Well, thanks for hanging out with us.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun again. And I hope you like the set.
We always post it as, when it comes time to announce the show, we always say, like, Ben Hayes came commander in with us. And so, thanks for coming commander in with us. To our listeners, thanks for hanging out with us to the end as well. If you want to support the podcast for all the good things we put inside of your ears, and we put many things, don't we, Nate? Head over to patreon.com/commanderandmtg. If you want to give us a buck a show, it's now easier than ever. We actually have a special buck a show pledge tier. Ben, I hear you clicking. Don't, please don't. You've already done enough by showing up on our episode. Thank you, though, for the thought. If you donate $10 or more per episode, though, Ben, you can come join us in our patron chat community that we host over on Facebook. That's where we got Henry's and Jackie's and a couple of other folks' questions for this and other episodes. Or, Ben, if you really must, you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes. That helps out a lot. You don't have to choose just one either.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I, you know, just to say I appreciate all the questions that came in. They were fun to answer and gave me fun stuff to talk about.
Cool. I don't know if it comes through when we're talking to you because we're focusing so much on the set, but we love all of our listeners and our patrons. Their generosity is incredible. We cannot say thanks enough, but we try to name patrons every episode. And this time we want to say thank you to Marcus Ogier or OGA, Jeffrey Craig, and Henry Birch, whose last name is not spelled like the perfect tree from Minecraft. And of course, Henry Stuckenborg and Jackie, whose name actually means Jace's, the way she spells it, Miller. Our theme song was created for the podcast by Nate Burgess. Our logo was created for the podcast by Mr. Picto, with assistance from Kelly DeLuca. Terry Robertson probably handled the editing for this one. I'm going to say hi to Terry right now. Who knows if he'll leave that in. Thanks to Hunter Pruitt for putting the YouTube video together, another of our fantastic patrons, by the way, and a mean League of Legends player. And special thanks to our tech whizzes, Jesse Thompson and Graham Frank, and to Justin for his server space. You can reach us by going to our website, commanderandmtg.com. Our email is cast@commanderandmtg.com. And you can find us on all the social media by searching for
Commander and MTG Podcast.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a show on update?
Yeah, sure. He's, what was he doing? He was hunting gremlins.
Yeah. Is there a competition for that, by the way?
The North Queensbury Gremlinery.
Yeah.
Competition is in full swing, but it's only starts in the summer. This is like his tryouts for warming up his team for the, what did I say it was? North Queensbury Gremlinery.
Gremlinery, yeah. Well, good luck to Sean in the North Queensbury Gremlinery competition thing.
Mm-hmm.
On Twitter, I'm at KETJAK. So you'll follow me there for my individual comments. Nate, where are you?
I am at Mr. Plorg, MISTERPLORG.
And all complaints as well as well-wishing and cheering for the North Queensbury Gremlinery competition should be directed to at Copaine, C-O-P-A-I-N, 26. That's Sean's Twitter account. And we know that he monitors his Twitter account while he is hunting gremlins.
Yep, got a tweet.
Tweet. He often posts pictures of his kills there. Sometimes they look suspiciously like X-Wing fighters. Ben, would you do us the honor of taking us out?
What does that honor look like?
Sometimes guests will say, and that's our show, or guests will say this has been Commander in, or something else equally witty and pithy.
And final.
This has been Commander in. I'm Ben Hayes. I hope you liked hearing about Aether Revolt, and I hope you like the set. Thanks for listening.
Mandarin.
Excellent. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Now we will stop our recording.
So I hit this record button again? Or the stop button?
You just hit the stop button.